talk today about language reading in the brain and about applying cognitive neuroscience to the investigation of developmental dyslexia. So I want you to imagine that you're traveling on vacation to Germany and you're walking into a restaurant and you want to order a meal. And you're looking at the menu and the letters look quite familiar to you, but when you try to read them out, they don't really stick together. You're not able to pronounce the words you see, and some of the letters aren't even familiar to you. And it must feel very awkward. Now imagine that you're a child and you're in second grade and you're looking at a text, and the teacher is asking you to read this text, and you look at the letters and they seem familiar to you, but you just can't stick them together to make a whole word. And you're supposed to read it out loud. And the child next to you just did it so beautifully and easily, and now it's your turn. And you're getting so stressed. You may be a child with dyslexia. 10 to 15% of the population have difficulty learning to read. And these difficulties follow many of these children throughout of their adult life. What I want to talk about today is how can we study what is dyslexia, what are the underlying causes of dyslexia, and then what are some options that we as educators have to deal with this very challenging phenomena. And the cartoon that I have here just says, let's talk about, I can't even read it, it's almost like me being a dyslexic here, let's talk about that dyslexia problem. So imagine every time you look at a script, this is what you see, something that doesn't make any sense to you. Dyslexia and any type of reading difficulty is such a challenge, but also such an exciting thing for a researcher, because in order to study reading, you have to combine so many different disciplines. You have to look at the cognitive neuroscience. You have to use investigations from linguistics to understand the structure of words. Then we have to use child development, because reading is developmental. We're not born with the ability to read, and we as developmental psychologists want to track what changes as the reading skill develops. And finally, most important for us is how we as educators can use this information and apply it to the classroom. Edmund Huey, who was a very famous psychologist in the past century, said that to study reading would be the acme of the psychological achievement, because it is the most complex task that we as human beings can achieve. So it's a great challenge to study reading, but there has been a lot of progress made in the field. I think for students, specifically students who are interested in the mind-brain education, reading and dyslexia are one of the best examples of how you can use an interactive model to study this phenomena. You have the cognitive sciences, the neurosciences, and education. And in it's my belief that it's only within the interaction of these three disciplines together can we achieve a full understanding, and we can move forward towards really helpful remediation. And that's why it's exciting for me to talk to you today about dyslexia as an example of how you can bridge these three fields together. And this is part of this new field that we're trying to approach mind, brain, and education. Now I want to spend a few minutes about what is the definition of dyslexia, and why this definition is a great example of this interaction of the three fields. The definition I'm going to talk about is a very, very recent definition. It just came out this January, just a week or two ago, by some of the leading people in the field. Reed Lyon, who's really one of the top people in NICHD that really funds most of the research in the field, and then Bennett and Sally Shaywitz. They're both neurologists and actually PhDs that have done a lot of investigations in the field of dyslexia. This definition differs from previous definitions, and I want to say what this reflects of what we have learned in the past 10 to 15 years about the field. First, what they claim is dyslexia is a specific learning disability that is neurobiological in origin. So if in the past there were some suggestions that maybe has to do with environment or how you were raised, or there's some even people thought that it had to do with your interactions with your peers or your parents, recent research in genetics and neuroimaging have brought us closer to the conclusion that it is neurobiological in origin. There's some hereditary studies that show that it runs in families. Some of these insights were already brought over 100 years ago. People thought it had some type of neurological underlying pinning to it, but now really the new type of research can support this claim. Next, they claim that dyslexia is characterized by difficulties with accurate and or fluent word recognition and by poor spelling and decoding abilities. In the past, really up until the early 1990s, dyslexia was only defined as difficulty with word reading, with accurate word reading. The research I'm going to talk about today in the cognitive neurosciences and also in child development has broadened our understanding to, and then when we talk about word reading, we not only talk about accuracy, but we talk about fluency. And this is something that I will elaborate on my talk today. And we can see this reflected, the research in the cognitive sciences reflected in this definition. They also say that these difficulties that children with dyslexia have typically result from a deficit in the phonological component of language that is often unexpected. So in the slide I showed before, I showed how linguistics is also part of our investigation of dyslexia. So we see here there's a tight relationship between language and reading that I will elaborate further in my talk today. And our understanding of what is phonological processing and beginning to understand how it relates to reading is now reflected in the definition. Finally, they claim that secondary consequences may include problems in reading comprehension and reduced reading experience. This is where the developmental track of reading takes place into the experience of the life of the dyslexic child. So not only does his dyslexia impede his word recognition, further on, it goes on to impede his problems in reading comprehension. These are much more complex cognitive processes, and when we study them, we can't only use neurology or genetics or linguistics. We're going to have to use more sophisticated models of the mind and of understanding to study that. But then there's also a cyclical relationship where when you can't read, you read less and less. And this is where your life experiences also affects your development. So I want to give you some statistics, and they're quite difficult, but we have to know them in order to know how important it is for us to study this. 17.5% of children in the United States are estimated to have learning disabilities. The majority of these children have reading problems. The National Reading Panel reported that 40% of children in fourth grade have difficulty with comprehension. This is not to say that all of these children are dyslexic, but it says that reading comprehension is a great challenge, that we have to understand how children learn to read and then what are the strategies that we can use in order to have them better comprehend. And finally, 2 million children receive special education services. Many, many of these children receive services that are related to reading. So this really, just to get a better sense, this is approximately represents 5% of all school-aged children in the public schools. And then we have the private schools and the religious schools that are just not accounted for. Probably also many children go undiagnosed. On the other hand, we also have to think about whether some children are diagnosed and they don't have a problem. So we have to look at both ends of the spectrum. Is everybody who really has a difficulty, is he being treated? And what about children that may be placed in the wrong educational setting for them? So if you want to have the face of the child with dyslexia, what is that face? Well, There is no one face. There are many types of faces. They come from diverse backgrounds. They come from high SES, from low SES, from urban, from suburban. You find them everywhere. They come from diverse cultures. You don't find one specific culture that has more difficulty with dyslexia. Also, you find it across all languages. No language is immune to dyslexia. You find it in Hebrew, in Japanese, in Arabic, in Turkish. It's true that some languages seem easier to learn how to read. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. Some languages are more transparent. And when I say that, it means that the relationship between the letter and the sound it makes is more regular. So for example, when you think about English, and vowels can make so many sounds, that language is more challenging to learn how to read. Nevertheless, even in regular orthographies, in regular writing systems, you find children that have huge difficulties learning how to read. There is contradictory evidence concerning minorities. So some say that you find the same proportion in all minorities. However, there are statistics that suggest that African-American children are diagnosed 4 times more than Hispanic children, for example. There may be several reasons for that. One is probably how they do on a task that's called phonological awareness that I will talk about later. So it may have to do with the relationship between children who speak African American vernacular English, their dialect, and the tests that are used to diagnose dyslexia is not the best match to catch these children. Finally, there are contradictory evidence concerning gender. There are some studies that suggest that many more boys have dyslexia than girls. But then in a systematic study done by Shaywitz and her colleagues, when they really use very strict criteria, they found the same ratios of boys and girls. And perhaps some girls are quiet and shy and they sit in the back of the room and they have neat handwriting and they don't get diagnosed as often as they should. So what is the outline of my talk today? I want to take a 3-tier approach to discussing this phenomena. First, I want to talk about cognitive development. How does language development relate to reading development? These are two things that obviously develop, are obviously interconnected, but I want to talk about the similarities and differences between language development and reading development, and how that relates to how we further are going to think about the underlying causes of dyslexia and the underlying remediation processes. Second, I want to talk about what we have learned from neurobiological research. So what have we learned from neurobiological research regarding how does language relate to reading development? And what have we learned from neurobiological research about the underlying causes of dyslexia? So I basically want to take the same questions and build them together and show converging lines of evidence. So we start with the cognitive development and we're moving to neurobiological research. And then, finally, I want to say how we can use these two bodies of research and apply them to education. So what is the application of this type of research? How can we go from the cortex to the classroom, if we can? And not to say that we can, but we're beginning to see the road and the path that we're going to pursue further on in the future. So the relationship of spoken language development to reading development is a very big and complex question, and today I can only attempt to take a small piece of it and begin to answer it. When we enter first grade, or even kindergarten, we enter and we start to learn about letters and we start to learn about written language, we actually come in with a knowledge of spoken language, which is very important. Our knowledge is complete. So when a 5 or 6-year-old is beginning to become familiar with letters, he already knows about words. He knows about sentences. He knows how to talk about plural. He knows how to express himself with words. He understands words. However, for this child, this knowledge is implicit. It's in the sense that if I would ask a child with how do you make plural or what is gender in language, the child will not know how to answer that. So it's implicit, it's not conscious in that sense. Or if I ask a child, what is a split infinitive? The child wouldn't know what a split infinitive is, but he would probably use it grammatically correct in a sentence. Another important thing is that our knowledge of words, our knowledge of language, can be applied to metacognitive tasks. Well, what are metacognitive tasks? And what is a metacognitive awareness of language? Metacognitive awareness, or I'm going to call it here metalinguistic awareness, is an awareness that language, we can think about language as an object. We can think about what language allows us to do. So one example is that language allows for us to control time. I'm right here in this room, right now, in this present moment. But with my metalinguistic awareness, I can talk to you about the past, I can talk to you about yesterday or centuries ago, or I can talk to you about tomorrow or the next decade. And we can travel with time using language, and I'm aware of that. Also, metalinguistic awareness is the idea that we understand that words are detached in many senses from the meaning of them. For example, we have the word automobile, which is a long word, and the word train, which is shorter. And here on the slide, you're seeing them clash. But if I ask a child at the age of 6, which is longer in length, a train or an automobile? A child at that age, when he starts to acquire reading development, can already differentiate that although train is a shorter word, it's longer as a physical object. So the idea that you can understand that words are separate from their meanings. This is a symbol system that words denote. Words are abstract and they denote meaning outside of themselves. When we talk about the acquisition of spoken language, how babies learn to speak, there's many research, a lot of it done by leading people in this city, by Chomsky, by Pinker, Steven Pinker, who's just here at the Yard in the psychology department, that point to the idea that language is innate. And I'm not going to talk about it in detail, but here are some of the lines of evidence that point to that fact. Language, the acquisition of language, is relatively rapid. You're almost complete with language development by the age of 5, and really children who are 10 years old really exhibit mature speech patterns. That's very, very quick. Those of you who are in your doctoral program, think how many years you have to pursue your doctoral degree in order to become an expert in a field. Those of you who are teachers, think how many years it takes for you to really be in a classroom in order for you to feel that you have this skill. It's a long time. So speech is relatively easy. Then there's some dates for milestones for language development that they may vary a little bit across culture or across specific children, but they're relatively fixed. And in your own time, you can go over these milestones. But what's important that, you know, around 6 months, you start to babble. 12 months, a lot of kids use one word utterances. For some, it's later. For some, it's earlier. But this is a sequence that's relatively fixed. And again, by 2.5 years, some sense modalities using negatives. You know, there's a terrible two when you say no for everything, but you learn to use it in a more complex way. Questions. And then 5 years old and 10 years old. Research by Laurent Petitot that you can watch actually also demonstrates that deaf children go through a very similar sequence. So you find it across different populations of children. And I think that's fascinating. There's some other interesting things that happen with language development. First, there's a critical window, or something that we sometimes call a sensitive window for language. So children that are reared in isolation or that had brain damage usually do not develop normal language skills. they would have usually difficulty with syntax. So though some of them are able to compensate some language, it's not normal language development. Also, spoken language is not taught directly. So I'm going to stick with the example of the plurals. So although children know how to use plurals on almost any word that they want, they haven't heard it. So maybe they heard the word toy and toys. But when Jean Virkel Gleason did studies and made up words like wag and asked children, what is the plural of wag? This is one wag. What are many? Children know how to use it without hearing it and without it being taught. Finally, children from different socioeconomic cultures, family backgrounds, families that speak a lot to their children, sometimes even maybe too much, and families that are just very sparse in what they say, they all develop language. And they all arrive at the same grammar, something that Chomsky calls the universal grammar. Now, I want to talk about some of the structural aspects of spoken language. And the reason I want to talk about it is because then these structures of aspects of language, we're also going to find them in written language. And then we're also going to use them as key identifiers for children who may have difficulty or may be at risk for having dyslexia. So these are key terms, and I know they're a little bit technical, but I think it will be really helpful to go over them. The first is a morpheme. A morpheme, and when we talk about the whole process, the process is morphology, is the smallest meaningful unit of a word. So in this word toys, the word S is a morpheme because it denotes plurals. Children who have difficulty with morphological processing or with morphological development often would go on to have difficulty with reading. Syllable. Syllable is the minimum unit of rhyme in our speech. So for example, the word Andrew, little boy Andrew, if you want to know how many syllables, it's two, Andrew. And what we sometimes let children do is tap to how many syllables they hear in a word. And this is how we can get a sense of their understanding what a syllable is. Phoneme is the minimal sound unit in the word. So let's say I say the word cat. The word cat, think for a minute. How many phonemes does the word cat have? Well, it has three. K-A-T. It's very difficult for children to understand this. What is the minimal sound unit that we have? And if they don't understand the minimal sound unit, if they can take a word like cat and break it down to phonemes, it's going to be later very difficult for them to map it onto letters and to make these associations. Written language. So we've talked a little bit about what are some milestones, why we think that language development may be innate, universal, goes through very similar process in different cultures and socioeconomic backgrounds. Well, what about reading development? This is Steven Pinker. As I said before, he's right here in the psychology department. And he wrote in 1997 that, and I'm going to read this quote to you, children are wired for sound. And these are all the examples that I just gave you before. But print is an optional accessory that must be painstakingly bolted on. It's not easy. It's not natural. It's not going to pop into your head. And just like we talked about before, how language doesn't need to be taught, reading does. And I'm going to talk about why and what is the evidence that shows that and how we can take cognitive development and neurobiological research and combine that to prove this. Because there's a great debate that finally, I think we're over this debate, but in the 60s, and then it came back in the 80s, there was a great debate in the field of reading. And Jean Child, who passed away a few years ago, who was one of the leading figures in the field, and was also a very important member here of the Human Development and Psychology, was one of the leading figures in this debate. Now, what is this great debate? A great debate was between a group of people who said that language should be taught as a whole. This field is called whole language. They claim that language is a natural process, and if you just expose children to the books, to joy of books, to a very supportive environment, just like language developed naturally for them, reading will develop naturally for them. On the other side, the other group claimed that although it's very important that children love books and love words and are exposed to it, just as Steven Pinker said, children are not wired to learning to read. So let's look at a very crude development of the writing system. There's also debate of when writing starts, but we can estimate that writing starts around 2000 BC, which means that we have writing systems for around 4,000 years. Granted, we have spoken language for much longer. People talk about 40,000 years to 100,000 years, and I'm not going to put it anywhere in that spectrum, but even if we take the more modest estimation of 40,000 years or 30,000 years, you can still see there's a huge gap between when language development and when writing development occurred in our civilization. Also, the way that language developed was first from pictures, and then from pictographic representations, and then logographs, and only later in the development of the writing systems did the alphabet occur. So alphabet is not that new to our civilization. So although we have writing as a civilization for around 4,000 years, it's only for the past 200 years or so that the majority of people are learning how to read. Reading was really restricted to priests, to ministers, to really people who were in the religious form, and then to intellectuals, to people who came of wealth. Women were almost rarely taught how to read. So really the idea that every person should know how to read is a rather new phenomena for our culture. And I mean the culture of the human beings. I don't mean the Western culture. This, just so you can see, is an example of Hittite. This is cuneiform. I would hope that none of my children have to learn how to read it. It's very difficult to learn how to read because there are over 200 signs. They all look very similar to each other. And it's also, you rarely find it on clean tablets. So you'd find it on statues, you would find it on walls. Our language has come, our written language has come a long way since then. So now I'm going to talk very crudely about what are the stages that a child has to go through when he learns to read. And this is adapted from the work of Jean Shaw. As I said before, she was here, and for those of you who are interested, I recommend you go down the reading lab that's named after her. So the first stage that she calls the pre-reading stage is usually for children around kindergarten, maybe a little bit earlier, when children start to understand print. So they start to understand that there are letters, that they mean something. Usually they can learn how to recognize their names, or use to recognize things that they see on cereal or on signs outside. But it's just the idea of beginning to understand what print is. Then when they enter grade school, they learn how to decode. And this is a critical stage, usually around age 6-7, when they understand that these letters that they see have a relationship with sound. And they have this grapheme-phoneme correspondence, we call it. That, for example, when I read the word decoding, I see the word D-E, and I can say D. And then I can continue to decode the rest of the word. This is the stage where so many of children who have dyslexia get stuck. They understand about print. They can even learn about letters. So although many think that dyslexia means letter reversals, it's really not that. That's a very big misconception. The majority of children who have difficulty learning to read have difficulty understanding these rules of written language. Then we go into the next stage, usually around third or fourth grade, that's called fluency, where they already understand the rules of how to decode words. But they become very fast and automatic. you have a whole bunch of children that although they're able to learn how to decode, they never become fast or automatic. Also, in regular languages like German, for example, that they don't have the crazy system that English has, and most children actually learn how to decode. I've done some work on Hebrew showing that Israeli kids that have a regular system don't have difficulty to decode. In those languages, the difficulty arises in the fluency stage. So when you're assessing for dyslexia, it really depends on what language you're assessing it in to be sensitive for it. Then Jean Child talks about the third stage of reading development, which she calls reading for learning. So if up until fourth grade, children really learn how to read, from fourth grade, they read in order to learn. This is where if you can't read, you're missing so much of important information. Probably most of our information we get from the written word. Even think about today that email has become such a critical part of our life. Imagine you couldn't read your email. And then you go on to develop multiple points of view, later in middle school and high school, and then it's really a whole other level that you can construct and reconstruct a text and see what it is mean, what is it influenced for, but this is really for later stages in development. So let's take the simple word cat, that if you remember has three phonemes, and we have to say, well, from a cognitive point of view, what are the processes that are required for me to read this word for you? Cat. Well, first, I see the letters, right? C-A-T. And I have to visually extract the features. Then, I have to understand that what I'm seeing are actually letters. So I have to recognize the pattern. So we have pattern recognition. Then, I have to map on the sound that the letter makes. So this is this grapheme phoneme translation. Not only that, then I have to recognize it. After I've recognized it separately, I've used these rules to create a word. I then have to lexically access what the meaning of the word is. So I have to go into somewhere, this dictionary, and to access this template and to map a meaning to it. And then I can say the word cat. I don't necessarily understand what it means. So then I also have to comprehend it. After all of that, I have to articulate it. I have to say the word cat. So if you look at all these processes, they're not necessarily sequential. We need each and every one of them. These are all many, many cognitive demands. And the reading process can break down in each and every one of those, or at several of those at the same time, concurrently. Also, we can think about reading as this interactive process that has many, many linguistic processes involved. There's phonological processing, we talked about what phonemes are, really the relationship of how language is built. Then we have orthographic processing. Orthographic processing talks about the recognition of letters and the recognition of letter patterns. So if you remember in the graph from just before, these are the extraction of the visual features and the recognition of the letter patterns. We have semantic processes, but that's higher up. Those are higher level processing in the models. And if you want, you can just go back and look at the slide from before, where you have to extract the meaning of the word. Then there are morphological processes. Remember when we define morphology, it's really the smallest unit of meaning in the word. So what if it was the word cats? Then I would have to really have the analysis of the S for the plurals. And finally, you have to have syntactic processes, which is really understanding the structure of the word within a sentence and the relationship of the word to other words in a sentence. So if you take all of this together, you can see that reading requires many processes that have to work together. You have to orchestrate all of these processes together. Now, for children with reading disabilities, it may mean that reading can break down at the letter of the letter, the level of the word, the level of the sentence. It can break down in any one of these processes. And it also means that different children are going to have different profiles. You're never going to find two children that look exactly the same. One child might have more difficulty with phonology. Granted, most children that have difficulty reading have difficulty with phonological processes. However, you can have a whole series of other sets of processes. And this is what's very important for me, for you to take away, is that when you look at a child, you would want to be very sensitive to what's going on with this child. Where is the problem? Because then you would be able to tailor an appropriate intervention. So here's the big question. Do language spoken acquisition properties hold in written language development? So we've started to see some of the shared processes. However, if we think about innateness and we think about the great debate of whole language versus systematic teaching of reading, when we talked about language development, we said that what points to it being innate is that it's rapid. Well, is learning to read rapid? Not necessarily. For some children, it may be very rapid, and for some, it just may not be at all. Are there fixed universal milestones? No. Some children, really, it's easier for them to learn by reading whole words and then just memorize the whole words. For some children, it's easier to learn really by sounding out words. Yes, we would want to teach every child in very similar ways, but it doesn't mean that they go through the same milestones. Is there a critical window of time when you can learn to read? No. We can teach adults how to read. You can look at the work of John Strucker, Rosalind Davidson. It's difficult for adults to learn how to read, but they can. It's not that structured in time. Is it not acquired through direct teaching? Well, many parents come to me and say, oh, my child just learned by himself how to read. It just happened to him. Usually what you find out is that, well, the child maybe the child has not learned how to read in school, but definitely the mother or the father or a sibling have spent many hours with the child reading books and maybe implicitly teaching them the rules of language. So I don't think if you would put a child secluded on an island or a few children, they would learn by themselves how to read the way you find, for example, with children or with deaf children that develop language without direct teaching. Another question, is mature skill acquisition relatively imperious to background issues? Well, no. We know that children that come from houses that have more books learn how to read faster and with less difficulty. So definitely your background plays a big role. Your literacy environment, your house, your interactions with your parents around issues of literacy play a very important role. So all of these taken together, the absence of these characteristics suggests that we are not biologically prepared to read and that we have huge responsibilities as educators to teach our children how to read, and we have huge responsibility as clinicians to find the children who have reading disabilities and to work with them, with their strengths and with their weaknesses. But what is this profound connection? Because we don't want to throw this connection away. We want to use the connection of reading and language when teaching to read. Well, writing is really parasitic on speech. We have words, sentences, grammar. We have these same units in spoken and written languages. And when we teach children to read, we want to talk about these units. The English writing system is morphophonemics. So the morphology I talked about, you still find it in writing. And also the phonology, you find it in writing. These sound-symbol correspondence. Granted, writing is a second-order symbol system. That's how Vygotsky called it. First order is what we talked about before, how words are abstract and they represent meaning in the outside world. Well, writing is a representation of words that are a representation of meaning. So that's a secondary-order symbol system. But it still has phonology in it. So we have to use it from the spoken language to then help us with the written language. There's also research to suggest that good readers and spellers are the ones that are really sensitive to the structure of language. They understand phonemes, they understand syllables and morphemes. And that helps us then recognize the patterns much more quickly and accurately. And also there's a large body of research to suggest that language-impaired children who develop late, who have severe difficulty, not just a little delay in development, but really severe difficulty with these concepts, always then develop difficulty with learning to read. So what are the differences? We saw the similarities, and it's important to use these similarities, but there are also differences that we have to pay attention to. Well, there's a difference due to modality. They're just different modality. We talked about the difference due to innateness. Also, written language is an artificial construct. If you think about this page that I'm reading, it's outside of me. When I'm speaking, it's coming from inside, but this is artificial. This is man-made, what I'm reading to you today. It's cultural development, and it's technology. You have to use technology. You have to learn how to use a pen and how to use, you know, a pencil and a book. Today we have to use how to use computers and printing. So there's an interaction of the human being with technology. Also, you have to bring this unconscious knowledge that you had about spoken language, and now it has to become explicit knowledge when you learn the rules of reading. You have to know spelling rules, punctuation rules, phonics, these grapheme to phoneme correspondence. So it's much more systematic, and you have to really have it explicitly in your mind. Also, there's something about the conceptual complexity of language. The little boy that you see in the slide is a deaf boy learning to read. For deaf children, it's very difficult to learn how to read. But when he has this book, and this book actually makes print permanent. So in a way, you can go back and forth. So it's more difficult, but then you can skip a word, go back a word. And granted, when we speak, maybe you didn't understand every single word I say. And now because we have the video, you can go back and listen to it. But in online, you don't have that type of relationship. Also, because it's written material, sometimes if you have time to reflect on what you're writing, you can express more abstract ideas than in everyday language doesn't necessarily always come true. You need more time. That's why many of us, when we have to give talks, we actually write them down. So we have it permanent. We've thought about how to formulate our ideas, and then we read them out loud rather than just say them out spontaneously. So now, I want to talk about what are the underlying causes of dyslexia. We saw several of the places that could be potential problems of dyslexia from the models, the cognitive models that I've showed you. But what has the research shown us? What I've talked to you about are different hypotheses of where a language could potentially break down. But what have we learned from research? Well, this is just a picture from the 14th century of children learning to read. And I was happy because there's also a little girl over there that's learning how to read. So I wanted to emphasize that. So we have the different stages of reading development. More than 20 years of research support something that's called the phonological deficit view. The idea that dyslexia is caused by a phonological core deficit. Now remember that phonology or phonological awareness is the ability to recognize sounds and words. So for example, if I do give you the word cat, and I say, well, children who are at 5 years old can't say that it's k-at, are very likely in the future to have difficulty learning to read. There have been many studies that show that this one task I just described to you is one of the best predictors of later reading difficulty development. Also, this view really concentrated on acquiring context-free words. So really just giving children a list of words and see how they do about it. It's limited in that view because, as we talked about, reading is much more complex and abstract, and there are sentences and comprehension. This view really focused on word. So then the diagnosis was really based on these types of tasks and letting children read from single lists of words. And then the intervention was also targeted just to remediating that. It's very, very important to remediate that. But we don't think it tells the whole story of reading difficulties. So this is, if you want to go back later, these are some of the tasks that are used. And you can go back and look at that. These are some of the researchers who have been very prominent in the field of phonological processes in the past 20 years. But as you've heard from Kurt Fischer, we want to move to look at reading process, to look at any cognitive process, really, in cognitive development, not as a ladder, but rather as a web. We don't want to see reading as something that everybody goes through the exact same step, the exact same universal step. But it's something that is much more dynamic, that has multiple pathways towards its development, and multiple pathways for the potential breakdown. So how do we apply, just to remind you, this is the view I presented before. These are all the potential places that can be broken down. So if you want to shift from viewing reading as a ladder to viewing reading as a web, it's a shift towards viewing reading as hierarchical and seeing that it's all multidimensional, and probably a lot of it has to be orchestrated in the same time in the brain. The research I presented to you briefly on phonological core deficit, that's still extremely important. But we want to expand that to look at other, multiple sources of reading disabilities. And the same with intervention, to expand what we can do with children and to tailor it to specific profiles. So some of the most exciting work that it brought to the shift from viewing reading as a ladder to reading as a web, again, was generated here. A lot of it was done by Jean Shaw and by these other researchers that started to look at what is the ability of a young child to name a letter to then predict reading. So before we had the phonological awareness task, this is a different type of task. If we talked about phonology, remember I then talked to you about orthography. So here's a whole line of research looking at what is the ability of letter naming to predict reading. Then you also find this type of research in the neurosciences. Important work by Geschwind. Geschwind hypothesized that if you name colors very quickly, that your ability to name colors and the time by which you name them by will predict reading. Well, he was wrong, but he was very interesting in how he thought about it and the idea of what happens when you name. And then his students, Denklin and Dell, developed this task. Now take a few seconds and name out loud to yourself these letters as fast as you can. I'm going to wait. Now what you can see that it looks like a very simple task, but it's not. And for some of you, maybe it didn't even feel simple. For some of you who maybe English is not your first language. For some of you that maybe reading, you have a history of your reading disabilities. So what is it about this task? It's called rapid automatized naming, RAN. Well, first when you see the letters, you have to give attention to the letters. I'm going to go back here. You have to give attention to the letters. Then, it has to be bihemispheric. Then you have to, again, recognize the letter patterns, right? Then you have to extract what they mean. Then you have to retrieve what they mean, and then you have to articulate it. Now, does this sound familiar to you? This has many of the components that I showed you in the reading process. So basically, there's a lot of overlap in these two tasks. Another thing that you have to have here is visual eye movement. You have to track with your eyes the letters. This is a reason why this task is such a good predictor of later reading. And research by Wolf, Bowers, and others, Scarborough, have shown that both the RAN task and the phoneme awareness task each make independent contribution to reading. The RAN task is a stronger prediction to reading fluency. Now go back to the beginning of the talk. One of the changes, the recent changes in the development, in the definition of dyslexia, is that they're incorporating fluency within the definition. So this body of research from cognitive neuroscience, from all these groups of researchers, are now helping us understand that reading is not just accuracy, but it's also fluency. And now it's going to be applied in practice in how we identify children. And this is just a representative study, studies, if you want to look at. Then Wolf and Bowers, if we talk about different profiles of children, again, expanding from a ladder to a web, hypothesize that there may be different subgroups of children with reading difficulties. Average children, where everything is intact with them. Children with a timing deficit, that they have difficulty with the RAN task. That's what's going to happen because they're so slow to retrieve these words, and it's hard for them to hold it in their memories. Then they have difficulty with comprehension. Then we have children that have difficulty with decoding and with the phonology tasks. So they're not able to read the words. That's why they have difficulty with comprehension. And then we have children that have both. Now this conceptualization is only the first step. We do not believe that there are only three types of deficits. There are probably many, many more. So if you go back to the model, we would have to look about what happens with syntax, what happens with morphology, and what happens with semantics, and to expand that. So now I want to see, well, this is what we've learned from cognitive development. What can we take from the neurobiological research and tie it together with this line of research? But let me just pause for 1 minute before I continue and say that when we talked about the different groups of children, you have on video these different profiles of children. Now what I urge you to do is to look at the video with the children with different types of reading disabilities that you have online and to try to think to yourself which child fits which profile, a naming speed, a phonology, or both, or neither, or is something else going on with this child. But now let's go back to the neurobiological research. And I want to start with a quote from Aristo. And, of course, the brain is not responsible for any of the sensations at all. The correct view is that the seat and source of sensation is the heart. Well, it's a beautiful quote, but just like Geshe-Win was wrong, he was wrong, too. Well, the human brain. I'm just putting it up for you just to kind of recapitulate the different areas of the brain and what we think they're involved in. And I want to take us back to this journey of language and reading. So we saw language and reading in developing children. Now let's see language and reading in the brain. Well, how do we map cognitive processes into the brain? You can look at brain lesions, and you can look at brain imaging. And then there are other ways and techniques that are developing and exciting. But I'm going to focus on these two. So what happens when you look at the effects of brain lesions on language? And this is very crude. Think of it as a diagram. Don't think of it as anything specific. So brain patients that have difficulty with speech productions, usually this is where their lesion is, in an area that's called Broca's area. And this is, again, very crude. Patients that have difficulty with speech perception, they don't understand what they're taught, but they can actually produce speech, usually have lesions in this area, Wernicke's area. And this temporal lobe is where naming ability is. So usually if you give a patient or even you give a normal participant in a study a picture and you ask them to name the picture, this is the area that lights up. So how do we now conceptualize this reading language connection in brain research? Well, we agree that brain is built on top of spoken language, and we've heard the evidence for that. But there are lesions that affect language that often affect reading as well. And then there are lesions to other regions that only affect reading specifically. So if you go back to the great debates, is language and reading exactly the same? No, because reading requires many more processes than we can now see in the brain. Also, reading is much more interconnected. So the challenge of learning how to read that we're soon going to see in these brain imaging pictures is much broader, because it's all these regions that have to work together, while language is more modular in our brain. So this is some of the most of the studies of reading with brain imaging did not look at morphology and syntax that you saw in your broader model of interactive reading, but rather they focused on orthography, the visual features, the letters, phonology, word sound, and some about semantics. But really almost nothing has been done about syntax and morphology. So if you want to look at this model of the reading brain, and this is a model that was provided by Sally Shaywitz recently, she summarized all of the studies where you had to, for orthographic processing, where you had to identify letters, and you can see this in the back of the brain in the occipital area, then word meeting in this temporal parietal area, and then phonological processing, really these tasks that you can go back and look at in the areas that you saw that were activated more in language, in much more frontal areas. Now, how does this relate to effects of brain lesions in reading? So remember, this occipital area is where letter identification is. So there are lesions that impair reading but not writing. So if we have patients that have lesions in this area, so they can't identify the letters, but they can still produce them. This area, the angular gyrus, is an area where lesions impair both reading and writing. And this is why Desjardins, over 100 years ago, he was a French neurologist. He hypothesized that this area in the brain is a translation station. This is the area where phonology and orthography come together. So this is the area where you recognize the letters, and then you move it on to see what sound it produces. So tasks with normal subjects, and this is a crude summary, these are the areas when you just give like a rhyming task in the scanner that lie out for normal subjects, not for patients with lesions. The inferior frontal cortex, the temporal cortex that, remember, had some naming ability, and this inferior parietal cortex that also is involved in retrieving of meaning. Semantics. So we see when you have to say the definition of a word, this area lights up again, this inferior parietal, and again this temporal, and again some inferior frontal. So you see some overlap. So when you really want to examine the studies, what we do is that we systematically look at what tasks were used. Because the researcher, for example, can say, oh, I'm looking at a phonology task. But really what he's doing is a semantics task. So that's why you have to be very careful in examining the studies you read. What are the tasks that are used? And finally, orthography, as with the brain damage patients, is very much in the back of the brain. Well, what do you find with reading? You find with reading two separate roots that are usually activated, a dorsal root and a ventral root. One root is a direct root. So when you see the word lock, you go from the word lock, I'm going to move here just for this one. You see the word lock, and you recognize the letters in the back of the brain in the occipital area, and you immediately go to the area where you retrieve meaning. And you just say it out loud. However, there's an indirect route through this temporal parietal region and inferior parietal region where you actually, you phonologically decode the word. So you go lock, lock, lock. So there's a direct route and an indirect route. And these, both of these routes, you see that are activated in skilled leaders. So what we wanted to do is actually to see, remember there was this idea of phonology, phonological processing in RAN, and they're both good predictors of reading, and children with dyslexia can have either one or the other or both, to see where these areas are activated in the brain, and do they underline the same processes, or do they give activation in different, or do they really, does it mean that they're different processes? So, for those of you who are not that familiar with how functional MRI works, what you typically do is you use a subtraction method, where you give a task, and then you give a task that's very similar, except on the one dimension that you want to look at, and you subtract them. So what we would do is that we gave three different types of rapid letter naming cards, and then we gave a different task that we subtracted where the subject just had to look forward. So he didn't have to move his eyes. And then another task we subtracted is when the subject had to name objects. So we wanted to see the difference between what happens when you name a letter and you name an object. To look at phonological processing, we let the subjects sit in the scanner and they saw two pictures, and they had to say if the two pictures start with the same sound. And I want to pause here because I think I want to raise an issue that's relevant to many studies in phonological awareness with brain imaging studies. Most brain imaging studies, what they call phonological awareness, is when they give, for example, two words and the subject has to say if the words rhyme or not, or two letters, and the subject have to say if the letters rhyme or not. Now, there's a great confound, because remember, when we define phonological processes, it was not print-mediated. So this is a confound, and when theory gets applied to research in the scanner, this is, for me, a reason why there should be great collaboration in neuroscience research. Because if an educator and a linguist would sit together and design a study, they would use the appropriate stimuli and then the appropriate labels. They wouldn't call it phonological processing. We were careful in our study not to use letters, so we can really differentiate between what's involved in letter and what's involved in phonological processing if you want to map the relationship between what's different and similar and reading and language. The subtraction task was when the subject saw two objects and they just have to say if they represent the same object or not, two different representations of the object. So here's what we found. For the phonological task, we found these areas that are very encapsulated, very modular, very similar to what I've shown you before of what represents phonology. This is in the left, mainly in the left hemisphere, and a little tiny bit of phonologist activation in the right. For the RAN task, where we subtracted the objects from it, you can see that there's less activation in general. It's more distributed across the brain, and one area that we were excited was the angular gyrus. This area that Desjardins thought more than 100 years ago was a translation area. So what we can see is that these two tasks have shared and different patterns of activation. So we can take what we found with the children, now we're finding it with regular adults, and now we're also going to run it. We've only run this on regular adults. Now we're going to run it with children and then children with dyslexia. But when we think about these different areas of the brain, we see that the RAN task really activates areas along both routes, the direct route and the indirect route, and it can help us link theoretically why we think this task may be relevant. And this is just for you, for any of you who are interested, you can go back and look at the different areas that come up significant that are activated. But just to summarize this, when we start thinking of linking cognitive development with neuroscience, neuroscience can give us a glimpse of what's going on. It's only a glimpse, and there are many, many limitations. But it can help us in reciprocally building theories. So you come up with hypotheses, you see what areas are activated. Let's say, for example, a different area was activated that we didn't even think about. It can help us rethink of what is this area involved in another task? What does this mean about this task? And then in the future, what will this tell us about the profile of the child? It also can help us understand meaning. When you look at the different meaning studies, it can help us understand that reading is involved in temporal regions, frontal regions. So when you design an intervention, you would start to think about how do you orchestrate these areas together? How do you create activities that target these different processes? I want to take a big, big step of caution and say this is one study. There have been very limited amount of studies with dyslexics in general. So we still have a long, long way to go in order to understand what's happening more with the dyslexic brain before we want to jump in into interventions. But we want to have this dialogue on together all the time. The next example I want to give you is shifting us towards remediation. This is a study that recently came out with a project that's called, with this, an intervention that's called Fast Forward. So what you see here is very interesting. For the normal children, you see areas of activation in the back of the brain and here in these more frontal areas. For the dyslexics, this is really around Broca's area. For the dyslexics, you see more activation, a little bit more in inferior areas, and almost no activation in these two areas. These children went through a remediation that targets more temporal processes of language. After remediation, oh, and another thing is that this is actually the left side of the brain that they're showing here. What you see with the children that went through remediation is increased activation in the right side of the brain and more activation in these areas that previously were not activated before. Now, what we can start to think about is that there's a remediation model that we can begin to learn about from this investigation and a compensation model. So these children are using areas that they have not used before, that are not used in the average reading processes, plus they're showing more. Again, I'm going to play a cautious role. This study was done on 20 children. Only 9 of the children in these studies show these types of gains. Does this mean that the program didn't work? No. Does this mean that this program is a solution for everything? No. It means that probably for some children with some types of deficit, it may be helpful. And then we need to replicate this study in other populations and in other ages to learn more about it. But this helps us think, for example, about a compensation model that we didn't think about before, which I think is fascinating. So, to summarize this piece, and this is Ornstein, I'm going to read this to you. We are heirs to the Greek intellectual tradition, one of the single file logic and rational analysis. And it is not only the formal arguments of Aristotle that have been passed down, it is the alphabet itself that may play an unexpected role in our brain organization. Because we have to take all of these areas together and to orchestrate them. And possibly for different children, they're going to be orchestrated a little bit different as they're learning to read. Thank you.